Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to introduce Jack Leffler. He's a writer, oral historian, environmentalist, and radio producer. And we're here today to talk about a subject which is very tricky to talk about, which is new ways of thinking about the environment. Welcome, Jack. It's great to have you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
Let's start with this poster. I'm looking at it right now. It's a poster that represents a map invented by John Wesley Powell, and it divides up the west of the 100th meridian, into what could have been states, but not by straight lines and rectangles the way we have all over the West, but rather by watersheds.
Absolutely. John Wesley Powell was truly an amazing man. He rendered this map largely from horseback, which is pretty amazing. This map appeared originally in the 11th annual report to the United States Geographic Survey. And it's 1889 and 90. Now, he figured out all of these different watersheds throughout the American West. And even though there are a few little hazy boundaries with regard to this, he pretty well got it correct. And his whole motivation was, after having gotten west of the Continental Divide, actually west of the 100th Meridian, rather, he realized that this is a very arid landscape relative to east of the 100th Meridian, which is very verdant and wet. And so he thought that, considering the extreme aridity of the American West, that it would be more sensible to organize the West by watersheds rather than in the geopolitical mode, which we did end up doing. And he almost made it. He lobbied vigorously before Congress to try to get this to happen, but Congress was more motivated by turning habitat into money. And subsequently, we're in the way we are now.
Now, who was John Wesley Powell?
John Wesley Powell was, I think, born back in Illinois. He was a totally self-educated man. He was a son of a Methodist minister, hence the name John Wesley. And he became a part of the Civil War for the side of the Union. And at the Battle of Shiloh, had one of his arms blown off. And that didn't seem to bother him at all. But at any rate, he was one of the very first people, if not the first person, to mount an expedition to go down the Colorado River, which he did a couple of times, in wooden dories. And the story goes that in his dory, he would sit there as his men were rowing down the Colorado River and read to them from Wordsworth. Really amazing guy. And he got more and more interested in it. He also became extremely interested in the Native American peoples throughout the American West. And one of the things that's not generally known, at least I don't think it is that he was the first director of the Bureau of American Ethnology, as well as being the second director of the USGS. He was extraordinarily adept at both being a bureaucrat, but being a hardcore adventurer and researcher. He was a real natural scientist.
Interesting. A bureaucrat and an adventurer, those don't usually go together.
They sure don't. Not in my experience anyway, but he was one of those people, and he had this enormous curiosity. And subsequently, he traveled throughout the American West and rendered this map, which to me is one of the most key things to look at. I regard it as a deep work of art on many fronts because it really delves deeply. Not only is it beautiful to look at, but it delves deeply into one's psyche when one really starts thinking about it.
So the West, if you were to take this map and pretend that each separate watershed was a state of the Union, be what, more or less the same number of states that are actually there?
When you look at the major watersheds, I suppose so. There may be a few more. However, each of these major watersheds, each one is rendered in its own color. One of the things that kind of cracks me up is that the Rio Grande watershed looks to me like a seahorse is seen from the left about to hop over the Continental Divide.
Right.
And that's in green, and part of the Colorado River watershed is in blue, and other part is in yellow. And then there are different hues within those primary colors, and those represent tributarial systems within the context of the watersheds. And all told, if one really counted the various hues, there are about 150 of them, so there are a lot of them.
And so let's just back up to the very most simple question, which, what exactly is a watershed?
To me, a watershed is not just the water, but it's the whole geophysical cradle that contains a given watershed. For example, if we look at the Rio Grande, the headwaters of that are in the San Juan Mountains up in southern Colorado. And it's bounded on the other side of the San Luis Valley by the Sangre de Cristos. And that extends down into New Mexico. Now, all of the water within that watershed drains into the Rio Grande, which itself ultimately drains into the Gulf of Mexico. And it's interesting that the watershed of the Pecos River is also contained within a geophysical cradle, but it ultimately empties into the Rio Grande down near Langtree, Texas. One thing about watersheds is they don't recognize geopolitical boundaries at all.
Right.
For example, the Rio Grande, after it hits a certain place in Texas, actually is bounded on the other side of the river by Mexico. And having run the lower canyons a couple of times of the Rio Grande, it's about a 110-mile run, and back in the 70s when I did it, it was really remote. And it took about half a day to completely forget that on the left side of the river, on river left, was Texas, and on the river right was Mexico. All of that just went away.
Well, watersheds don't recognize geopolitical boundaries, but even more so, people who make geopolitical boundaries apparently don't recognize watersheds.
And that's one of the rubs, because especially now, we're beginning to understand that the biggest area of jeopardy, or at least one of the biggest areas of jeopardy that we face in the American West, especially in the Southwest, is the likelihood of a great reduction in available water. In other words, precipitation. Well, not that long ago, I read an article in the New York Times that said that they were anticipating, whoever wrote the article, that there would be up to 30% or more less precipitation in the course of a year than we're generally accustomed to. And my great friend Melissa Savage, who's a biogeographer, says that this drought that we're in is not a drought. This is the new norm. And so we have to begin to really look at water and what it really means. And if we look at it from the point of view of the watershed, it opens up a whole new possible way of thinking about the relationship of culture to habitat.
What are, just quickly, the reasons for this reduction in precipitation and in water here in the West?
Well, it's associated with global warming. The fact that whole meteorological systems are in a state of flux right now because of the carbon dioxide that we've pumped into the atmosphere, the whole system of climate is changing pretty rapidly. And certain areas of the world are going to receive far less precipitation than presently, or let's say than 10 years ago. This is, from the point of view of a human lifetime, this is a gradual shift. From the point of view of geologic time, we're entering a very abrupt change.
Right. So how does it affect the way one thinks about the environment to start thinking about watersheds?
Well, one of the things that I really do in my own mind is I associate the concept of watershed consciousness with a whole notion of bioregional thought. They're very interrelated. I have a good friend out on the West Coast who gave to me the very best definition of bioregionalism, and I'd like to read that. His name was Gary Snyder, and one of the most astute thinkers we have. and I quote, "Bioregionalism goes beyond simple geography or biology. By its cultural concern, its human concern. It is to know not only the plants and animals of a place, but also the cultural information of how people live there, the ones who know how to do it. Knowing the deeper, mythic, spiritual, archetypal implications of a fir, or a coyote, or a blue jay, might be to know from both inside and outside what the total implications of a place are. So it becomes a study not only of place, but a study of psyche in place. That's what makes it so interesting. In a way, it seems to me that it's the first truly concrete step that has been taken since Kropotkin in stating how we decentralize ourselves after the 20th century."
Had to put a little anarchism in there.
Well, absolutely, because the whole notion of decentralization is central, so to speak, to anarchist philosophy. And anarchist philosophy in this sense actually coincides perfectly with a natural way of looking at things. In other words, if we were culturally decentralized within each watershed, if we existed within the watershed conscious of that being the governing factor rather than just ourselves, we might get somewhere. In other words, the final act of governance is by habitat, not by human predisposition, even though we are so anthropomorphic to think that we can successfully govern. We have to pay infinitely greater attention to the habitat, because if we don't, we'll blow it. Or we're blowing it, as we can see as we go.
We're blowing it for all the various species on this planet, but also for ourselves.
Absolutely.
I mean, looking at this map, this this John Wesley Powell map, and looking at boundaries that were basically created by nature but perceived by a human being, and looking at the difference between that and boundaries that were imposed by a human being, the difference between perceiving something and going with that and imposing something very artificially seems to be a real difference between the way we live and the way, I mean, I don't want to idealize or romanticize native people, but the way some indigenous people perhaps have lived in their space.
Absolutely. I think that one of the characteristics that comes with our species is a territorial imperative, and it's not restricted to us. Probably almost every species, including creosote brush, has its own territorial imperative.
I know my dogs do.
Yes, indeedy, and they mark them well.
Yes.
But a creosote plant ostensibly secretes some sort of a substance, exudes a substance that keeps other creosote bushes from getting too close, encroaching too closely.
Amazing.
And this seems to be embedded in an awful lot of different species, including the human species. One of the things that we have to constantly remember is that we are an animal species.
Right.
And I think we have a tendency to forget that. But
and that being territorial is, I mean, if we are that way and creosote bushes and dogs and everybody else are that way, it's adaptive.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Now, one of the things that struck me, I've spent a lot of my life traveling throughout the American West with a tape recorder and microphones and the whole business, but visiting people of indigenous persuasions, different peoples throughout the West and Mexico. And they have different styles of life. But one of the things that's consistent with every culture that I've ever visited, especially for those who are really traditional within the context of their culture, is regarding the land as sacred. And our cultural proclivity is to look at it as monetary gain, turning habitat into money. That's a phrase that I've spoken before in many places, but
right.
I feel that it's a significant difference. It's about 180 degrees.
Now, that's an expanded way of saying resource.
Yes, it goes, though, from resource to commodity.
Right.
And
exactly.
The difference between resource and commodity is one that can be sold, whereas a natural resource or a resource that is natural to a given habitat is something that can be shared.
What does sacred mean?
That's something I've thought about a lot. Actually, the other day, I was looking up Freeman Dyson, who's a very interesting thinker. And one of the things, I've got something here, if I can find it, that he addresses when he was talking about science versus religion. And I don't think he took it far enough, so to speak. But at any rate, Freeman Dyson says, Science and religion are two windows that people look through trying to understand the big universe outside, trying to understand why we are here. The two windows give different views, but they look out at the same universe. Both views are one-sided, neither is complete. Both leave out essential features of the real world, and both are worthy of respect. Trouble arises when either science or religion claims universal jurisdiction, when either religious or scientific dogma claims to be infallible. Now, I think that really says something here. He's restricting it to sort of a Western cultural point of view with regard to religion, but in my experience among the native peoples, there seems to be a natural bent toward seeing the habitat itself as being a very sacred place, and that the human species is secondary in importance to the habitat itself and shares the habitat with the other members of the biotic community, but on a deeply spiritual level. And you can see this going to any of the annual dance cycles up and down the Rio Grande from the different Puebloans or being out in Hopi and going to their various ceremonials. Those are annual cycles that are fixed in time, ways of celebrating the mythic process, which to me is the way a culture or even a single human being intuitively defines oneself relative to habitat, to where we are, gives meaning to why we are here. Now, that sense of the sacred, it's interesting. Years and years ago, Jerome Rothenberg, who is deeply into poetry and thinking in these terms, wrote a wonderful book called Technicians of the Sacred, which was an anthology of Native American poetry that had a spiritual hue to it. And it was a beautiful book. It is a beautiful book. I have it. I've had it now for 40-some years. But what interests me is that some people from within our culture can sense the sense of the sacred that's experienced by many of the Native American people. Now, there are all of these concepts and ideas that go in and out of fashion. And the notion of the noble savage came into fashion, went out of fashion, comes into fashion, goes out of fashion. But my good friend who is no longer with us, Alvin Josephi, pointed out that back in the 60s and 70s, that a huge number of people from monoculture, say, really were seeking to align themselves as spiritually as they could with people from Native American culture. Well, it didn't always work.
Just to back up for people who haven't heard that term, the noble savage, that it refers to the idea of the indigenous person being pure and good and close to the earth.
Absolutely. The photographer Edward S. Curtis did a phenomenal job of photographing a lot of different cultures throughout the American West. And he romanticized them in a big, big way. And his photographs are still highly, highly prized.
Right.
But you can really see how he saw the noble savage, and he was pushing this notion. But what he was sensing, I think, was the way that sense, that natural sense of animism that became the foundation, or remains the foundation, for many of the Native American cultures, that is truly where it's kind of coming from.
And it's funny because within, I think, probably every culture on earth, there are very strange contradictions, like cultures that are animistic, meaning everything is alive, everything is sacred, everything deserves reverence, and then they terribly mistreat their dogs.
Well, that's true. Sometimes they even eat them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had some dog meat stew once. I was traveling down in central California. My car broke down and a band of gypsies took great. Well, they invited me into their camp and I had some dog meat stew and it sustained me.
I'm not judging it. I'm just saying there are these strange contradictions. And in our consumerist culture, there's tremendous amounts of awareness and compassion, even as we're destroying the earth.
It's a matter of degree, and nothing is fixed. When you think about it, there are a myriad ways of interpreting our presence in the universe. And science is one way of trying desperately and diligently and assiduously to satisfy a curiosity in a very empirical fashion. People of a more spiritual bent, and that's not to say that I don't know an awful lot of scientists who they love the mystery. You know, everybody is seduced by the mystery. How could one not be? What's interesting is trying to get, as Freeman Dyson said, it's just trying to get a handle on the nature of reality. And one of the things that strikes me is that consciousness itself seems to be an evolving attribute and maybe a whole new dimension unto its own within the context of a universal imperative. And that's something I think about a lot. In other words, why consciousness? Is it an accident, or is anything accidental, or is it in response to some urge? My friend Ed Abbey pointed out that from his point of view, it was entirely likely that rather than coming at the beginning of all things, God comes at the end of the universe. And I think that's an interesting notion.
We're talking to Jack Loeffler, writer, oral historian, environmentalist. Now, we can wax philosophical, and it gets pretty abstract, but I want to get back to this concrete thing, because you have a phrase which I would love to get you to try to explain, which is thinking like a watershed. Now, the watershed itself doesn't exactly have a cerebrum and a cerebellum and all that stuff, but we do. And first of all, thinking, does a watershed think?
You are a watershed, and I am a watershed. Water goes in, water comes out.
Excellent point.
And within our personal watersheds are gazillions of cells that aren't us. In other words, we're the support system for an incredible amount of stuff. And we are very much...
without which we cannot live.
That's true. In other words, the whole thing is interrelated big time.
Right, right. I guess, but if you look at the body as an ecosystem with lots of different species in it that are not our DNA, you're already on the way to thinking like a watershed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you can just take that fact of our individual bodies, our individual personal watersheds, with our cerebrums and our cerebellums and the entire neural system, and transpose it into looking at a given habitat, a real watershed within the context of a geophysical environment. And it doesn't take a huge skip in imagination to understand that a watershed is very much like us. In other words, it's the same thing. We inhabit the watershed of the Rio Grande del Norte. Actually, we could say that we inhabit the watershed of the Santa Fe River. But when you look at the whole thing fitting together, there are all of these human watersheds wandering around within the context of the larger watershed. And if we just make that little additional jump to understand intuitively that what keeps us healthy is exactly the same thing that's required to keep the larger watershed healthy.
So what are some of those things in terms of the larger watershed? What is the process? I mean, is there an equivalent to digestion and so on in a watershed? What is the watershed's, like, let's look at the area in which we're living right now. Water falls from the sky. What event ends up in the Gulf of Mexico? But in between, lots of things happen. What happens?
Well, a lot of things happen, including a lot of sedimentation. One of the watersheds that I got deeply into about 7 years ago doing a radio series called Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, I visited the headwaters of the major rivers that empty into the main stem of the Colorado River, including the Green, the San Juan, the Colorado itself. And one of the things that became very obvious was that a huge amount of sedimentation occurs. In other words, water is constantly eroding. The watershed is constantly shifting by virtue of just washing away parts of the mountains, so to speak, the headwaters.
So water falls, and as it falls and runs downhill toward streams and rivers, it takes pieces of mineral matter with it.
Absolutely, but the watershed itself is not just the water. It's the container of the water. It's right. The body, the geophysical body. Again, Gary Snyder tried to talk about this at one point. I loved what he had to say. He said that he tries to imagine water running in all of the tributaries all at the same time throughout the entire length of a watershed. And that's a real exercise in imagination.
Right.
We're trying to imagine that happening. But it's more than that. The idea of a watershed is all of the biota that live within it, all of the organisms, and it includes all of the geophysical characteristics of it. In other words, you go to the mountains that surround the top of the watershed, and you see it go all the way down to where it finally is empties into the sea. And there's this constant motion. There's constant change. Absolutely nothing is static within the watershed. There's energy flowing through it, huge energy, because the nutrients that come down also feed a lot of the organisms. It feeds all of the organisms, really, that live within the watershed, be they floral or faunal, you know. And every organism is fed not just by drinking water, but the nutrients that are brought out are what really comprise the life of the watershed.
Now, is there a circular process where nutrients that go in one direction are then replaced through a natural cycle?
Not all nutrients are replaced. And other nutrients or other things may come into the watershed. In other words, one of the things that's very interesting to me is that it's been revealed, and I can't tell you precisely what it is, but the city of Los Alamos has a proclivity for releasing things into the watershed that might not otherwise have been released. Every town.
You just put that so delicately.
Oh, diplomacy. But at any rate, every town along...
Like what? What are you talking about?
Well, there are certain materials that are being dumped in.
Are you saying lab pollution?
Well, it's stuff that has been stored below ground, and sometimes it seeps in. When people back in the 1940s were working as hard as they could to create a bomb to try to end the war, the Second World War, stuff got stored in the ground that didn't necessarily, nobody could remember where they'd stashed it, you know, and stuff like that seeps in. You can see that septic systems empty into the river wherever you go. Albuquerque really had a thing going there for a while where a bunch of stuff was floating down past the Isleta Pueblo that was not particularly wonderful. In other words, they see a cow's hoof or head float by, and they were looking at all of this stuff, and it was the whole collective of what got dumped into the Rio Grande. One of the things that our mutual friend Bill DeBuis points out is that thinking in terms of a watershed from the human point of view, it's very important for people at the top of the watershed to be very conscious of the people at the bottom of the watershed, and that we all approach living here in a collaborative fashion, because the resources that are yielded from a given watershed, rather than being commodified, should be looked at as shared resources, but not stuff that's to be taken out to the very nth degree. In other words, stuff has to come back and come back and come back. Otherwise, the characteristics are so changed that life as we know it won't survive in the watershed.
Coming back again and again to this map of John Wesley Powell that divides the West up into big areas that are essentially watersheds and then some sub-areas within those watersheds. Suppose that he'd been successful and that we were living in states that had these very organic, interesting-looking shapes, not a straight line anywhere. How would we live differently?
We would undoubtedly, if we were living within our watersheds in such a way that we were doing our level best within the context of our human population to not exceed the carrying capacity of the watershed, we would invoke the points of view, many different kinds of points of view, at least in my opinion, as to how we should collectively comport ourselves. There would be a good, strong science part, but there would also be a good, strong, almost spiritual sense of stewardship part of it as well. In other words, it would be, as Edward L. Wilson would call it, a consilience of points of view jumping together to really determine how we should comport ourselves within the context of the watershed as a collective entity. And this would not be something that was done on a professional basis, if you really take it to its highest utopian point of view, but rather something that was in the deepest sense a democratic way to approach this stuff, and it would not be dominated by an economic imperative, but rather by a biological imperative, or the sort of an imperative that displays how, if we don't do this correctly, we're going to all go away one way or the other. In other words, it has to be something that is based on as high a level of consciousness as we can muster. And that's something that we haven't really displayed. We are capable of a high level of consciousness, but thus far we haven't really displayed it as well as we should.
I've been thinking quite a bit lately about the ways in which our economic system and our health are at odds with each other. And there's a lot of obvious things, like we are expected to do too much in too little time, and that's stressful and things like that. But then there's another aspect to it, which is, if we were all to grow our own food, to make our own compost, to recycle our own water and catch rainwater, put our gray water in our gardens. I mean, I might not go so far as making our own clothes, but that's there's some locally produced wool, locally produced food. A great many publicly traded companies would become superfluous.
Well, that's true. To me, one of the highest callings is to re-achieve a state of living a handcrafted life. Now, that doesn't mean that every single individual is entirely responsible for absolutely everything one wears or eats or any of that stuff. But again, everything is approached collaboratively.
I don't even know. I'm not even sure what would be good and bad and what would be fulfilling and not, because there's a great deal to be said for having the comforts and luxuries and products of this economic system in which we live. But if we did all the healthy things, those things wouldn't exist. And it's a transition from here to there is a very daunting thing to contemplate.
Back in 1972, the Club of Rome gave a report, the Limits to Growth report, which really interested me. And they factored in 6 or 7 different areas where, if we were able to stop growing in those areas at that moment in time, we could indeed re-achieve a standard of living comparable to the United States in 1912. Interesting thought, because that was a pretty high standard of living. Actually, it's probably higher in many ways than our current standard of living.
It's hard to compare, because that was it was before electric lights and antibiotics and a lot of the things that keep us going.
That's true, but the thing is
and that radio.
It would be, that's true, but the point being that we would have things that were not available, say, in 1912, but the whole world could enjoy a lifestyle and a way of life, a healthy way of life, that would have been comparable to the comforts that were present in 1912. Now, that was at a time, since that report came out, the human population has grown by another 1.5 billion or 2 billion people. When I was born, the population of the planet was about 2 billion people. The turn of the 20th century, it was about 1.5 billion people, and it had been there for quite a while.
Yeah.
And now we're between 6 and 7 billion people. And if the predictions go as people think, or, you know, they assume it would go, barring total catastrophe, that we would finally level out at between 9 and 10 billion people on the planet by 2050. However, there's an awful lot of indication out there that we'll be reducing our populations quite rapidly well before then.
A thing that I want to get back to is, I mean, you talk about all these conversations you've had with indigenous people. We've touched on the meaning of the word sacred, and I think there's a kind of neither religious nor airy-fairy thing, but a pretty down-to-earth meaning of the word sacred that you've really been alluding to. We've been talking about science, and part of what you're about is really building bridges in thought and idea sharing between science and people who regard the land through the lens of the sacred.
One of the most profound ways to experience the sacred that I've ever had happen is to actually be, we've talked about this before, you and I, but to be camped for maybe 100 days out in it, out in the flow of nature. It doesn't take a heck of a lot of time. Either you go nuts, like my predecessor on the fire lookout ostensibly was practicing his quick draw and shot off a big toe just to get off the top of the fire lookout. But and another guy claimed to have spotted 87 fires all within the same 10-minute period. So it's not for everyone.
Right.
But for those who really get into that kind of a way of life, if you're out in it for any period of time, you really begin to feel an affiliation with the flow of nature that, at least in my experience, I've never felt any other way.
So some of us have experienced maybe a smaller version of that. I certainly, you're never going to catch me out in nature for 100 days, but, you know, whatever, it's a few nights here and there. But maybe everybody has a different way of experiencing that deep connection or is looking for that. But then here's what I'm interested in, the bridge to having a conversation with a scientist and having that exchange where the two languages overlap and are talking about the same things or are addressing the same things from different perspectives.
I think that that's entirely possible. As a matter of fact, I've seen it happen. I have two very close friends, Gary Paul Nabhan and Laurie Monty. And the three of us have spent a fair amount of time with the Seri Indians, the three of us together down there. Gary is an ethnobotanist. Laurie is an ecoethnologist. And I was doing ethnomusicology. And the whole thing that happened was that Gary brought his scientific knowledge and the Seris brought their understanding of how to comport themselves within the context of their habitat. And there was an exponential increase in understanding, both from the scientific point of view and also from the indigenous point of view. And I had the lucky job of being able to sit and record the songs, which are the mnemonic devices by which the Seri Indians understand their relationship to their habitat. And we were able to see that, in the words of Edward O. Wilson, a true consilience occur between people who are biologically, scientifically oriented and people who are indigenous to a given habitat and had been there long, long time, long enough certainly to understand how the whole thing fits together. Now, the Seri Indians have songs for each of the different species. And actually, at one point, another fellow, Tommy Venom, an ethnomusicologist from Smithsonian, and I were down there recording this one man singing the song of the leafcutter ant. And before he started to sing, he started to assume the shape of the leafcutter ant.
Really?
And he sang the song, and he became the earthcutter, the leafcutter ant. And when he finished, he gradually returned to being a human being. And it blew me away. And I knew, you know, he knew the whole repertoire of songs about the various species in that habitat. And the point is that if you know that repertoire in the Seri language and you're a Seri Indian, you have a complete understanding of Seri taxonomy. Now, if you take that scientific knowledge, which is very truly scientific knowledge, and meld it or bring it together with the biology as we understand it within the context of our own academic pursuits, we have a much larger, an exponentially larger point of view with regard to how to comport ourselves within the context of that habitat.
Well, that's the question. What does the Seri Indian song, dance, taxonomy, what does it give to scientific understanding of, let's say, the same ants or of the context of the ants that science doesn't have by itself?
There's a depth of perception. That's the only way I can put it.
Yeah.
In other words, there's
and
a feel.
And depth is something that, does science even recognize that concept?
Well, some scientists certainly do. Gary Nabhan sure does, as does Laurie Motti, as does Ken Wilson, an anthropologist friend, and others that I know. Steve Feld certainly understands that from having spent a lot of time with a group of people, the Kalali people down in New Guinea. Understanding their relationship to habitat and that depth of understanding, which goes into the sacred. You know, it's that spectrum that includes the sense of the sacred, that is missing from a purely reductionist point of view. Now, one of the things that I think is that the reductionist point of view is a very valid one, but as long as it's seen to be for what it is, in other words, a part of the packet of points of view that are possible to have when one looks at any given subject. And I think that, therein lies the whole point of view of thinking like a watershed. In other words, thinking like a watershed to me is thinking from within a sphere of reference rather than a frame of reference. In other words, you have a multidimensional sphere of reference. And that sphere of reference contains clusters of associated notions, ideas, thoughts, etc. And if you're going to take a reductionist path toward a given end, you go through that particular sphere of reference, going from dot to dot, from cluster to cluster, picking out what you want, and then continuing down the trail.
I think a question that arises is, how do we behave differently when we're taking a greater sphere of reference into the way we think and behave versus a reductionist sphere of reference? One thing that comes to mind, correct me if I'm going down the wrong track here, is, for example, the importation of some species of toads that will kill some pest that's killing your crops, but then that species takes over and kills everything else, and you have an environmental disaster that comes from introduced species. But you think, hey, organism A will eat organism B, and organism B is a pest, so let's do it.
This is where we start to get into a real danger zone. I have another friend out in California, Stuart Brand, who is well known for having done the Whole Earth Catalog many years ago, and also the Coevolution Quarterly, published that. But he's very much into the whole notion of biotechnics. And he feels that we have achieved, we're at a place in our own history right now and in the history of the planet itself, where we're going to have to do some genetic modifications in order to survive, which is absolutely antithetic to what my friend Gary Paul Nabhan has to say about Darwinian flow of nature and things like that. And I think that I'm spooked by thinking about what Stuart has to say. I recorded Stuart about a year ago talking about this stuff, and I've got up that whole, that'll become a radio program one of these days, but really trying to look at, we have to become infinitely more wise than we currently are before we start monkeying around.
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm asking is that monkeying around a manifestation of reductionist thinking?
Well, probably in part, yeah, it sure is. Now, reductionist thinking, I'm not saying that it's wrong. I'm just saying that it's one of many ways of looking at things.
Well, what does it lead to that's good, and what does it lead to that's not so good?
Well, what it leads to that's good is that if you follow a certain kind of reductionist thinking, in other words, if you focus on a certain species of sea tortoise or sea turtle and learn absolutely everything there is to know scientifically, biologically about that specific sea turtle, that, in a sense, is reductionist thinking. You're getting deeply into the genetic makeup of it, all of that kind of stuff.
But which can be a very valuable thing.
It can be a very valuable thing. However, if you look at the sea turtle from the point of view of the Seri Indian, you're seeing a very sacred being. And if that sacred being does not crawl up on the beach at a certain point in the annual cycle, the whole sense of equilibrium is thrown out of whack. Now, there is almost a symbiotic relationship here. It is very bizarre. I've witnessed some of this stuff and the way it works with different tribal peoples. They are so in tune with the habits and characteristics of other species within the context of the habitat, or even within the weather patterns, that they almost seem to have an effect on it. Now, how can you measure something like that? You can't really. But the point is it within the context of their own mythic process, their own collective intuitive way of perceiving things other than just the intellectual, they're finding a sense of balance and a sense of wholeness. And if you take the two ways of looking at things, and there are many ways of looking at anything, really, it's not just two, and I don't want to seem to dichotomize here, but if you take at least two different ways of looking at it, and maybe many different ways of looking at it, you really do have a bigger picture. One of the things, I remember I wrote an essay about 35 years ago called The Southwest as a Symbol, A Crystal of Many Windows. And I was thinking when I wrote that essay of being inside the crystal and having all of the many facets available to look out of, the different ways of perceiving the American Southwest as, to me, the mythic landscape. It was just a wonderful way to think. And that came out of having been a fire lookout.
Interesting.
100 years ago, all of the people who were rangers, forest rangers at all, in the American Southwest were in the process of getting rid of the wolves, the bear, the cougars, even the bobcats, the coyotes, thinking that it would make for a better land. And it took somebody like Aldo Leopold to come along and start generating a different point of view. He himself shot a whole bunch of wolves. And then he realized that that had been a horrible mistake.
Well, there's that amazing moment that he writes about.
Yeah, in that wonderful essay, Thinking Like a Mountain. Actually, I would like to quickly read something. It's about Aldo Leopold in the Southwest from his final essay in a Sand County Almanac entitled The Land Ethic. And I think that this is one of the most profound things. This certainly spurred me on when I was beginning this project of Thinking Like a Watershed, which has been, I'm working on it now for quite some time.
So that your title actually comes from Thinking Like a Mountain.
In a way, yeah. But one of the things that had struck me was that Thinking Like a Mountain was a little too inert. The watershed is constantly in motion. So's the mountain, but it's just hard to see it from a human perspective. But I'd like to read this. This is, to me, just perfect. And this is Aldo Leopold. This is from The Land Ethic, the very final essay in a Sand County Almanac, and I quote, "A land ethic, then, reflects the existence of an ecological conscience, and this, in turn, reflects a conviction of individual responsibility for the health of the land. Health is the capacity of the land for self-renewal. Conservation is our effort to understand and preserve this capacity. Quit thinking about land use as solely an economic problem. Examine each question in terms of what is aesthetically and ethically right, as well as what is economically expedient. A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. By and large, our present problem is one of attitudes." I think that that's really a fantastic piece of writing. And that's where he really nailed it. And he wrote that a long time ago. He died in 1948. And that book, A Sand County Almanac, really did set a tone for conservation and preservation and actually for the entire environmental movement thereafter.
We're almost out of time, but I want to leave our listeners with something that they can take home with them or take through their day today, which is, so we're starting to consider the possibility of thinking like a watershed. How do you do it?
Well, one of the first things you do is you go find out as much as you can about the watershed where you live, and then you intuit your relationship to it by recognizing that you yourself are a walking watershed. And then you apply the things that you would like to have happen to you to your watershed, and you become ever more savvy about what it takes for the watershed to remain healthy. And then you start getting everybody else to think that way if you possibly can.
How do you do it? How do you live differently than you might have before you started thinking in this way?
Well, I've lived pretty much the way I live for a long time. I've tried to live simply, to use as little as possible. I noted in my journal the other day that I was really hoping is that I'm soon to be 73 years old, that I have put back at least as much as I've taken out of habitat, so to speak, on one level or another. But I think that we have to understand that we are not necessarily the reason to be. We have to really get rid of that sense of the anthropomorphic that we are born into and really see ourselves more of the biomorphic, the terramorphic. We belong to the land. We are part of the planet. And if Edward O. Wilson is correct and we really let our consciousness take over in a proper fashion, we become the mind of the planet.
Jack Loeffler is a writer, oral historian, environmentalist, and radio producer. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. This was fun.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 505-428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.